Hey, this is Dizzy, and you're listening to Endeavors.
Sing to the bottom, only to wind the belly up on your bedroom floor. Innocuous form, I'm underwater half of the day, but still you wait till I'm ready to flow and carry me home. We'll be alright in the morning. The world is on fire, we'll be treading in the yard till I'm ready to flow and you carry me home. We're dancing outside.
Welcome to Endeavors. That was the single Swim by Oshawa Quartet Dizzy, and you'll hear from them a little later on. Also, we have actor Diego Klatinoff on the show today. He talks about his new film, Radius. But first, I'm kind of excited about our first guest. I am a film person, as listeners will know. And there's few films that reach the status of The Room. If you're not familiar, The Room has been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies and the best worst movie ever made. It was written, directed, and starring Tommy Wiseau, who clearly knew nothing about what it took to make a film. One of Tommy's best friends is an actor named Greg Sestero. And Greg and Tommy met in an acting class about 15, 16 years ago. Tommy initially hired Greg to work on the crew of the room and then insisted he be in it. Several years later, Sestero wrote a book about the experience of making the room called The Disaster Artist. The book itself got rave reviews. And now that book is a movie. So it's a movie based on a book on the experience of making a movie. The film is also called The Disaster Artist, and it stars James Franco, Dave Franco, and Seth Rogen, and it's out in theaters now. This is my conversation with Greg Sestero. Greg Sestero, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Glad to be here.
So, The Disaster Artist, this seems to have been quite a journey for you. You go and make this movie, you write a book about it, and now that book is being adapted into a movie. Has it all sunk in yet?
You know, it's been a really strange 8 years. I feel like any time I've kind of been blown away by something that happens with the room, you know, something else comes along and shatters that. And that's what's happened with everything. I mean, 7 years ago, I had this goal to tell this story and have that become its own film, which, you know, was a pipe dream in itself, but I really believe this could be, you know, a film like Ed Wood or Sunset Boulevard that could be a great story or great movie about a bad movie. You know, to end up here and have it be a reality is just something I think it'll take some time to really register.
And how does it feel? I mean, out of all the people to make this film, you get, you know, the Franco brothers and Seth Rogen, who seems sort of perfect to play the roles. How much, and I know you're in the film a little bit, how much consulting did you do with them on the project?
Well, yeah, I was really lucky to get, you know, these guys to make this movie because, you know, one of the biggest things, obviously, when someone's going to adapt your book or your memoir, you know, it's who's doing it. I think, you know, you can always kind of feel a little nervous going in, but I was really lucky to have these guys who were not only, you know, terrific actors, but really understood the story. I think James Franco did a review of the book early on and compared it to, like, Boogie Nights meets The Master, and that's kind of the dream of someone if you're going to turn, you know, their story into a film. And I mean, I was fortunate also because I had a lot of behind the scenes material from my experience working on the room, a lot of pictures, and so I just pretty much gave the production whatever I had to help them, you know, make the best movie possible, to see what it was like during that time. You know, obviously the terrible wardrobe, and which I still had that denim jacket, which Dave wears in the film. But I mean, just kind of giving them whatever they needed and sharing experiences from that time. But they were so prepared and so accurate with capturing the story. It was great.
I read that the judges at the Entertainment Journalism Awards stated that it's equal parts Ed Wood, American Hustle, and Demented Citizen Kane, with a dash of Monty Python thrown into the mix. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like that's maybe kind of what the movie was as well?
Yeah, it definitely has a little bit of that. You know, I definitely think it's Sunset Boulevard, Ed Wood, those are kind of the, you know, the pillars for Hollywood movies, and I think this one finds its spot in those, in that group. I think I've seen the film now 6 times, and it gets better every time.
Talk a little bit about The Room. I mean, you know, there are thousands of everyone starts off as a first time writer, first time director, first time filmmaker. How early on did you know that this was not going to be that? This was something completely different.
Well, I had known Tommy 4 years before making The Room. I'd been in LA for a little while. I'd had an agent. I'd done a few projects. So by the time Tommy came calling and wanting to make this, I knew how hard it was get anything made and to be taken seriously. So when I knew that Tommy had never really done anything and here he was going to write and produce and direct his own project, I just thought, there's no way this thing is going to get seen, because I knew how hard it was just trying to get anything. You know, I knew that obviously Tommy was, to me, was a very unique performer, and I found him really hilarious, but I didn't know if he would translate to a public audience, because at that point, anytime we'd walk in somewhere, people would be glaring at him like, who the hell is this guy? It wasn't in a very kind way. So I thought for sure they wouldn't pay money to see a movie that he wrote, produced, directed, starred in. I thought there was no chance for it. And ultimately, I wasn't going to be in it. I ended up in it in the very last minute because Tommy told me if I didn't make this film with him, that it would be the biggest mistake I'd ever make. And as insane as that is, he was right.
How do you feel about sort of the status that this film has had over the last, you know, decade and a half?
You know, it's funny because The Room has never been something I felt like truly embarrassed by or affected by in that way. I've always been fascinated by its arc, and that just the fact that people discovered it and watched it to me is mind blowing, because I was there from the beginning and this movie had no chance to go anywhere. And when people started discovering it, I was intrigued what they thought of Tommy and why they were drawn to him. And was it the same reason that they were drawn to him that I was in that acting class? And then when the film really emerged in 2009, 2010, and people really started seeing it, and there were articles about it, my goal was, you know, to make something redeeming about this whole experience. And I didn't really have much say in The Room. I didn't have any creative control. I was just like this passenger on Tommy's planet who kind of survived the whole thing and never really had a voice. And I thought, okay, I know there's much more to me than this bad movie. And I know there's definitely more to Tommy as well. And that's where my role kind of came in, as someone who could tell the story in a way that, you know, could make people understand what this was all about. And, you know, it took a long time, but I feel like I've finally kind of found that redemption and peace with being a part of all this.
What do you think it is about Tommy and his personality that fascinated so many people?
It's almost like seeing a guy stepping out of another dimension. You wonder how he just kind of gets through the day or pays his bills, and it's just somebody who feels very different. And I think, you know, normally this movie would have never gotten made because nobody would have helped finance it. Nobody would have distributed it. Nobody would have gone through with the script. And so you had a guy who had full creative control, had the money, and made all the decisions to make this movie. It's something we would have never gotten in a normal situation. So we're getting treated into a world that we've never seen before. And I just think it's a really unique experience. It's one of the most unique cinematic experiences you'll ever have. And that's a testament to kind of thinking outside the box.
You end the book about, you know, a meditation, if you will, about the sort of the power of unconditional belief in one's own dreams. Is that, where do you stand on that? Is it a good thing for someone to believe in something that deeply?
I think if it's for the right purpose, I think it can be a great thing. I think big part of the reason why The Room works is because Tommy was sincere and he put his whole heart into the film. It was his way of trying to be understood, not only by me, I feel like, but just the public or anybody, because it was, in a lot of ways, it was a cry out for help. He'd been misunderstood his whole life. You know, you go to these acting classes and people would kind of shoo him away, and he'd be like, you know, he really felt like he had something to offer and nobody was listening. So it was like finally he was giving his chance at his dream to be like a performer like Marlon Brando or James Dean, which he always saw himself being. So he was very sincere about the film. And so therefore I thought, even though it wasn't received in the way he thought, because even though he sees himself as a leading man, which, you know, that's not his strength, you know, he was still very, very much sincere about it. And I think if you're sincere about your dream and what you believe in, I think it can be a beautiful thing. But I think if you're doing it for the wrong reasons, you know, ultimately it'll leave you feeling empty. And I think Tommy definitely got fulfillment out of the room, even if people, you know, laughed at it, because he was getting that attention that he really wanted.
James Franco has been widely lauded for his performance in the film. Some are calling it his best performance since 127 Hours. Do you think he got Tommy down pat pretty well?
Yeah, I got to see a rough cut of the film a little over a year ago, and I was blown away. It's really an incredible performance, one of the best I've seen in years. Not especially because I've known Tommy for 20 years, and I really felt he was an impossible character to play, because to really play Tommy and make him interesting for 100 minutes, you need to get inside his mind. You need to understand what makes Tommy tick, and not just be a kind of operate on a surface level. And James really built the character. He became Tommy, which I didn't think was possible. And it's really, you know, he deserves all the awards for this performance.
You know, it's funny because James Franco, he's kind of another actor that's an enigma. What do you think it is about him that enables him to get into a character or a person like Tommy so well?
Just having, you know, observed and, you know, been a part of the film and been on set, James is truly an actor in every sense of the word. And there's just not many people like that left. I think he's a throwback to the great actors from like the 40s and 50s who just are actors. I mean, they live for it. They think differently. And they're able to go places that a lot of people aren't, that, you know, that they can't go. And so when James, you know, built Tommy, I mean, again, and he played somebody else that I thought was impossible to play, which was James Dean, back in 2001 and won a Golden Globe for it. So he's just everything an actor should be. He's just become obsessed with a part and, you know, analyze it from every angle and become that character. I mean, to the point where James was Tommy on set every single day. I mean, he's in character. And I think that's the kind of passion you need to have to pull this character off.
And how was it to have your mother played by Megan Mullally?
I thought that was pretty hilarious. I was there the day that they were filming her scene, and that's one of the most crazy experiences I've ever had in my life, was when my mom met Tommy and told him, don't have sex with my son. And so to be there and see that same Mercedes that Tommy pulled up in and watch that conversation played out was incredible. So I think my mom should be pretty happy that Megan Mullally played her.
Well, the film is The Disaster Artist, and it's opening in select cities on December 1st and then nationwide on December the 8th. Greg Sestero, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, ciao.
My next guest is also an actor, and I first became aware of him through his role as Mike Faber, best friend to Damian Lewis's Nicholas Brody on the hit series Homeland. Although he was only on the show for 2 seasons, he played quite an integral role to the plot as best friend and lover to Mrs. Brody, played by Marina Baccarin. But for the past 5 seasons, he's been co-starring with someone you may have heard of, James Spader, and in a little TV series called The Blacklist. In fact, when he phoned me the other day, He was on lunch break from filming the series' 100th episode. He's in a new film back home in Canada. It's a lovely little thriller about the apocalypse, in a way, called Radius. He is Diego Klattenhoff, and I spoke with him last week. Diego Klattenhoff, hello, welcome. Thanks for taking time out of your day today.
Thanks for having me.
How's season 5 of The Blacklist coming along?
We are shooting the 100th episode right now with Nate Mullane, and things are going great. We are kind of halfway through the fifth season.
100 is always a big milestone for TV shows. What does that feel like?
It's kind of business as usual, but a little bit surreal at the same time. You kind of remember a lot of different points of the series, and we just got to keep going. We still have a half of a season left, so it's you can't get too carried away reminiscing.
But in addition to doing your work on The Blacklist, you're also in a new movie here back in Canada with the film Radius. How did this lovely little piece come your way?
At the end of season 3, we were trying to hunt down something that was a good story, something that was well written, and it checked all the boxes at the kind of the 11th hour. I didn't think I was going to do anything. We had a few things that didn't work out scheduling wise, and then you're always kind of trying to find the right project that's worth your time, and because the show takes so much time and effort to shoot. So one of my reps got in touch with me, so he had a terrific script. Funny enough, it was from this first-time writer-director team from Montreal, his husband and wife, and they were fantastic, and they wrote this great script, and we just kind of read it like all the others, and it was what he said it was. It was a really compelling, gripping story, and it was a really fun ride to read, so and here we are.
Now, in the film, you play a character with amnesia, and considering a lot of acting is about, memories and trying to access that part of your brain, how do you go about playing somebody that has no memory?
I hit myself on the head a lot. it was just trying to act. It's just like you just have to approach it scene by scene, and really talk to the directors about what their vision was and who this character was, and starting the project. I know the ending, but it really doesn't dawn on me until the last, I don't know how many pages in, it would be the last 15 pages maybe. What really happened and who I was. So it was kind of something that I hadn't done before, it was very interesting.
You are a Canadian, even though you're off doing big things in the U.S., both with The Blacklist and before that Homeland. But what the experience of coming back home and working on the film, is there a different sense of feeling between that and working on something bigger in the U.S.?
Oh, it's always great to get back to Canada. I said it time and time again of being from Canada and growing up there and starting in the industry, and no matter what, I'll always be Canadian and have the certain sensibilities and kind of a shared experience of as a Canadian. But to step out of that and be away from it for a while, and then to come back and work. I mean, kind of puts things in perspective of where I come from and getting to where I am and all that journey along the way. You know, it's great to wake up and read the newspaper and, you know, not be tuning into CBC Radio late at night trying to hear what's going on. And it's always great to be back.
The film deals a lot sort of with memories or lack thereof, but also in intuition. I find both Liam and Jane have to follow their instincts because they have no memory. And how does that play into your work as an actor? Because you have to use your intuition a lot of the time. How can intuition help us, but also be dangerous at the same time, do you think?
Well, I think that there's several things in there, and you know, as an actor, it was very, very much an internal struggle, and not being able to with pretty much every project, you never shoot in sequence, so you know, you really have to play with these, the tone, the feel, kind of the everything underneath of how much did Liam know, and is there something that he's remembering that's kind of setting off a flag for him? And Stephen and Kara were terrific in you know, going along for the ride and really moving things up and down as far as not letting Jane know, and because I think Liam knows before Jane that something ominous is headed their way, and it wasn't a good thing. So, and as far as like, you know, how do you act that and how do you play it? I think it's just something that you have to approach every scene with and really be present in, you know, where you're coming from and where nobody knows on this crazy adventure where they're going to go next. So, we're just trying to very much like Memento, put these pieces together and put these kind of building blocks and build this foundation. And then the next minute, these memories will kind of piecemeal come flooding back, and you have to sort out this next kind of pile of blocks that just got dumped on top of you and keep going. So it was a really fun adventure as an actor. And, you know, as far as instinct and intuition and that, I think there's something to be said for trusting your gut and your subconscious in the day to day.
Speaking of trust, what do you think it is that makes us trust certain people? You know, like eventually Jane trusts Liam because she's the only, you know, he's the only person that's in her situation. But what do you think happens that leads us to trust certain people more than others?
Well, I think it's something in our self-conscious that, you know, for whatever reason, we something inside of us, I think it's all about instinct and survival, and that's what's kind of gotten us our little foothold in the world right now. You know, especially when you think back all these different generations that all these crazy things that had to have it happened, these chance meetings or encounters, or when you think about whether it's the wars or disease, plague, all these people that got taken out except for one of your relatives who, you know, stepped one foot to the left, the guy behind him got shot. You know, so it's something that I think that, you know, humans and people, you do have to pay attention to, and whether it's a sixth sense or, you know, it's just, you know, just like you said, just trusting your gut. I think, like, as far as even children, you know, I was listening to a program that was quite interesting about lying and, you know, telling the truth and lying, and why children have a keen sense of not being fooled by tricks. Whether it's body language and language itself, and how things don't add up. You know, their language says one thing, but their eyes are telling you a different thing. And kids instinctually don't trust people like that. So, you know, because in times past, you didn't get to survive. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for paying attention to that.
The other aspect, though, is that, you know, whenever you're sort of in a apocalyptic situation, you have to kill people to survive. And how do you think, both you as an actor and Liam the character, how do you think they justify these acts that they have to do in order to survive?
I don't think I think he was a bad guy to begin with, in some kind of, I don't know how you would really explain the cosmic event that maybe somewhere out there the cosmos wanted Jane to live. So I think, you know, maybe Liam had to take that into account. But, you know, I don't think we were off on some Bonnie and Clyde adventure knocking people off. And I think it was all about trying to make sense of the situation. Maybe it gave me a new sense of consciousness and I don't know, sense of humanity, instead of, you know, killing people left and right, as we find out in the very end.
You know, and what else is interesting is that it's never necessarily fully explained in a way, sort of what caused the event in the first place. How do you, as actors, and, you know, we always want to find causes for something, how do you look for something that is unexplainable?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, that was a really bad way of phrasing it. How do we explain certain events that maybe are unexplainable to us, as because we don't have the knowledge to understand what caused these certain things?
How do we do that? I think there's a lot of different ways to. I mean, people have been doing it since the beginning of time, trying to explain things, whether it's, you know, all these different religions and you know, now we have this funny little thing called science that people don't like to pay attention to, even though it's science. I think it's within people's kind of nature, once again, to grapple with these things, even though somebody says A plus B equals C, you know, it's called global warming. There's other people out there who, for whatever reason, it doesn't fit into, you know, what makes them feel comfortable. So, out of that, I think, you know, certain humans have to make up their own reason. So, I think that's kind of how we cope with things.
How did you find it working with two directors at the same time?
It was great, to be honest. We had a very, you know, male-female balance. Two people that at times it was the language barrier, because they were talking in French to each other. And Charlotte, who's terrific, and I would be sitting there getting eaten by the bugs and kind of looking at each other, then going, wait, hang on, Steve Carroll. What the fuck are you saying? What's going on? What are we doing? So it was a fun trip. And they were great. And then all of a sudden, you know, one would balance out the other, or there would be a something that, you know, it's just a different perspective. So it was a really fun ride.
We find out at the end sort of Liam's true nature. So why do you think in that very last scene of the film he makes the ultimate choice that he does?
I think that he can see the whether it's some moment of clarity that he has, and seeing how kind of pain and suffering that he's brought her, that you know, he has to do the right thing and make amends and kind of free her from this situation that, you know, he's put her in. I think that there's this kind of moment of clarity and humanity on his part, and feeling, and not just taking lives, but kind of doing the best that he can in that moment.
If you found yourself in a sort of similar apocalyptic situation, what do you think your best skill or quality would be to help you try and get out of it?
My gut, my reasoning. You know, it's I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to, like I said, sometimes just blind luck gets you through, and the guy next to you gets shot in the face, and for whatever reason you don't. You know, you just gotta keep going, and you know, I think a lot of it comes down to persistence.
And finally, I know you guys are in the midst of shooting the 100th episode. What can we look forward to from your character this season on The Blacklist without giving too much away?
I'm in a bit of a pickle these days, kind of, you know, with what's happened to my character and situation that I've gotten myself into inadvertently. Not my fault, just a little accident. But, we're in a really tight spot right now in the middle of the season, which is really exciting to see how it's going to play out in the next, 3, 4, 5, 10, 11 episodes. It's kind of an exciting place. Got a few, I know we just had the fall finale, so I'm trying not to let out any spoilers or anything, but we've had a few big things happen, and it's a pretty exciting time to be shooting the show, and I guess people are just gonna have to tune in and ride this one out.
Well, Radius opens December 1st in Canada, and The Blacklist Season 5 is airing right now. Diego Klatinoff, thanks for jumping on the phone today.
Not at all. Thank you, and I hope everybody enjoys the movie.
All right, have fun shooting.
Thank you. Okay.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was my conversation with actor Diego Klatinoff. The current season of The Blacklist is now airing, and you can find Radius in a theater near you, in Canada at least. My final guests are a band that's so new, they don't even have a full album released yet. Off the top of the show, you heard their new single, Swim, but this quartet from Oshawa has been making music now for quite a while. They are three brothers consisting of Charlie, Alex, and Mackenzie Spencer, along with their friend Katie Munshaw on vocals. I spoke with them the other day after their show at the Drake about what it was like working together from such a small community and how that impacts their creativity. Here is my conversation with the band Dizzy. I'm here with Dizzy. Hello, everybody.
Hey, hello. Hey.
You just got off stage here at the Drake. Charlie, I remember you mentioning before the show that they pushed the set times back and didn't tell you.
No, they didn't.
How do you adjust mentally for something like that?
You go have another drink because you have time to.
Yeah,
just recollect.
Do you find that as a performer, having a drink before a show gets you into a certain state or mood?
No, not necessarily. Something I could do with or without, I guess. But it's nice. It's nice to have the time to be able to relax and take the edge off a little bit.
So you guys have two singles out right now. Stars and Moon. I had a chance to listen to that earlier. Where did that track start for you all?
I guess it started in the computer in my bedroom at home. And I had this little idea that didn't sound anything like Stars and Moon sounds now. And then I sent it over to Katie, and she sort of took it from there. and came up with most of the lyrical ideas, and then we just sort of hashed it out between the four of us for a little while until it was a full song. And it was one of the last songs that we wrote out of the group of songs that we were working on at that time. But it came together really, really quick, and we felt really, really good about it.
How would you guys describe your overall writing process?
It often happens a lot like that, or sometimes I'll have an idea that I had already thought of.
And just sort of stretch it out with with guitar and bass and whatnot, and fill it up a little bit. Yeah.
It's never really the same. It sort of just happens how it happens.
Your second single, which is how you guys ended the show today, is Swim. I know, Katie, you mentioned that it's about letting people help you once in a while, which as artists, I find that can often be difficult for us to do. What was the impetus for that song? Do you remember?
I feel like I'm someone who tends to bottle a lot of things up sometimes. And just having someone to lean on is nice, and I just felt like writing about it for once. Something that isn't so pessimistic. It's a little bit
cathartic.
Yeah.
What do you think? You know, a lot of artists I talk to talk about that, the sort of different ways of dealing with their emotion and how they tend to bottle it up and it comes out in their writing. Why do you think we tend to gravitate towards that way of coping with things so often?
Oh God.
I honestly don't. Like, I don't do that. It doesn't happen that way for me. It's not like I feel something and I have to write it down like I could do without writing, really. Sometimes I'll get a line that just comes to me and it just sticks there, and I can branch off of it, but I found that I'm actually quite good at it, in the sense that we've written a couple songs off of it, so I keep doing it, but I could not do it if I didn't want to.
But there are some, I've heard of people who that's the only way they can express emotion is through song, which I almost feel bad for those people.
Yes, I don't do that. I cry quite a lot.
I think it's more of a subconscious thing, right?
Yeah, definitely.
You don't realize it. Yeah.
I heard you guys describe that this music was sort of a way to combat the anxieties of the vortex of boredom.
I
love that phrasing. What is it about having nothing to do that can put us in a somewhat fearful state of mind?
See, it's like a nervous energy.
Yeah.
Like fidgety, mm-hmm. almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody in the world these days has like ADD, and especially when you live in modern suburbia where like there's absolutely nothing to do, except for literally like walk to the grocery store and wander the aisles, it can get a little like almost scary. Just that sort of, it's almost a fear of missing out mm-hmm. on something that you don't even know is happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's weird because you sort of described Oshawa as it's modern suburbia, but it's also very dense, and yet, you know, your neighbors are there. There's a lot of space between you and your neighbors. So
no, it's the exact opposite. Actually, you could pass something from one house to the other through the window.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the houses are very close together in Oshawa, in northern Oshawa, in the suburb, the suburb that we're in. Everything's very close together. Houses are close together. Getting to anywhere that you really want to be is very far away.
What is that like in terms of, because you always hear about suburbs, that there's a distinct sense of community that's maybe not present in some of the larger urban centers like Toronto or like Vancouver. How does that, maybe that environment affect you guys creatively?
I feel like, you know, at least for me, we know our neighbors quite well, and like you get a sense of who people are very easily because you're so close to them, and everybody likes to talk about people or to people. So I think that is a bit different. I mean, we know I know everybody in on my street, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit of a culture shock when you come to Toronto or any bigger city where, like, there's all these people and you don't know any of the faces. And
they don't know each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I might be wrong, but...
playing in the big city, though, I mean, you guys have played here numerous times before, and it's not that far from where you guys grew up. Is there a certain comfort maybe in playing a gig that is still so accessible for many of your friends and family and fans?
Oh yeah,
it is now. Before, it was super daunting coming here. Like, it's Toronto, it's the big city that we've always kind of been looking at from afar, like an hour away. Mm-hmm. But now it feels a lot more like home, even though it's not. But yeah, it feels a bit more comfortable now. Mm-hmm.
So I know Charlie, Alex, and Max, you guys are all brothers. Mm-hmm. So not only are you creative partners, but you grew up together. What's it like being a family, but also sharing this experience together?
Very easy.
Yeah, it makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, very simpatico. There's no conversations really, like, really direct conversations about the creative process. It would just sort of feel...
Yeah.
We've
been playing music together forever, so communicating is easy. Mm-hmm. I wish we'd just figured it out sooner, that we could just play together kind of thing. Because there's that sort of... When we were growing up, at least, you have people like Hanson and the Jonas Brothers, who are brothers in a band, and it's cheesy as hell.
Katie, how do you feel about playing with these guys? They're obviously your friends, but they're all brothers as well. How do you feel about this dynamic?
It's pretty wonderful, actually. A lot of people come up to me and they're like, how is it being the only girl in a band? And I'm like, it's actually great. It's the best. I'm really lucky that they're all so nice and funny people. Yeah. And they already have, like, a dynamic, so I fit really well into it, I think. So, yeah.
You guys got to work with a couple of great producers on this album. I know you worked with Damian Taylor and Nixon from Colorado. Mm-hmm. Working with people like that who are not only experienced musicians, but also experienced producers as well, how does that feel for you guys just as artists?
We're still getting used to it. We didn't know what we were getting into when we started working with Damian. And it turned out being super natural and really great. But it's kind of scary, like, these things that you made in your basement or your bedroom that are, like, so close to you, then, like, giving them to someone so they can scrutinize it to right down to every little detail and tell you that this might not be right and this might be, like, maybe move this here. It hits you in a personal spot, but you just sort of have to get over that and realize, like you said, that they have the experience in that field and what, like, they're giving you good advice. It's not like they're just telling you your song is shit kind of thing. But it's been really fun being able to work with other people.
So we mentioned the two singles, and I heard that the album is being prepared to come out early or sometime next year. What are you guys learning and enjoying about the process of putting together a full collection of songs?
I'm really proud of what we have. Mm-hmm. I think they all kind of stand for the same thing. I think they're all stories in my life that I had and that I'm looking back on, and they're kind of like these things that hurt a lot in the moment, but they don't hurt as much anymore, and they're kind of like a collective of those things. So, I mean, I'm really proud of what they are.
I don't think we realized we were making an album until it was done. We were just writing songs and mm-hmm. writing more songs, and we didn't know what it was going to be.
So it feels more like a collective.
Yeah. I think we're just lucky that all those songs fit together really well, because some people will write hundreds of songs and still not have an album, you know what I mean?
Do you find that when you write a couple of songs that are maybe similar in theme, that maybe informs you how to write the next songs that sort of fit that same kind of area?
I'd say we were on a certain tangent for this record. We had sort of broken into a certain sound that I feel like we all really, I guess, resonated with. Yeah, enjoyed. It'll be interesting to see where it goes next, because who knows, like, next album could have a different sound that we break into. But yeah, for the 10 songs, right?
Yeah.
On the record, I think we were in a more or less cohesive headspace for all of them.
You guys write a bit about on the website about being stuck in highways a lot, both in Oshawa and on tour. So what is your wackiest road memory?
Ooh. The first thing that comes to mind is when we were absolutely halted on the 401 because there was an accident ahead and everybody was getting out of their cars and just...
We were
sitting on the roofs of cars and stuff.
Yeah, we were on our way here, actually, to the Drake to play a show. And we were calling the promoter and saying, like, we might not make it. We're standing on the highway.
Getting to know
the people in the car beside us who were asking what we were up to.
It actually ended up being the show that Laura, who's our manager, was at, and then we got linked up with Royal Mountain, who we are signed to. So it was a blessing in disguise that we were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. If that accident had taken any longer, we might not be sitting here doing this.
What are you guys looking forward to most about this specific tour that you're on right now?
I'm really excited to go to New York. I'm going to a viewing of The View. Have you seen the show The View with Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar? I love that show. I'm so excited to go. Just had to say that.
We're going to Washington, D.C., which is crazy.
That'll be new, yeah.
That'll be cool to see the White House and all that fun stuff.
Do you think there's going to be a different energy when you go down south?
People don't know who we are, so that's, it's always nice to be like, hey.
Yeah, introduce people to our music just right off the bat kind of thing. Yeah, like we've played a few shows in the States before and they've gone over really well, so I'm excited to see what the response is like going down the East Coast.
Well, the album is coming out. Do you guys have a set release date yet?
Nope.
No.
Sometime in the first half of 2018. Dizzy, thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with the band Dizzy, Charlie, Alex, Mackenzie Spencer, and Katie Munshaw. We're going to take you out with their song, Stars and Moons. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
To see stars and moons. Come and watch the waves. into sourness. So how could you believe me when I say to you that no one in my hollow heart holds a candle to you? I am starting to see stars and moons. This is how it ends, a courageous boon. Tips into all your words.